the gift of witchcraft.
I was able to see, hear, and communicate with spirits.
A very personal relationship between a person and spirit.
Carnal lust and fun things like that.
Working with different energies and spirits and communicating.
Creating magic.
Powerful ritual and powerful spells.
She's actually sticking me in the cauldron.
The role of the witch is to make change.
Bless it be, y'all.
Bless it be.
People ask me, like, okay, I'm a witch and I don't know what to do.
20 years ago, three young friends realized they were witches. They scattered to different parts of the world, following magic and spirit. Now, they're back in their hometown to share what they've learned.
Welcome to That Witch Life Podcast, your home for living as a witch in today's world.
Welcome, everyone, to That Witch Life Podcast. I'm Hillary, your host today. I'm joined by Courtney and Kanani, my co-hosts.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, it's morning for us.
Yeah, it's
it's a little early for us, so we're a little tired today.
A little tired. First of all, we wanted to open the episode. We've often spent time recommending to you various resources, books, blogs, other resources for you to read about and learn about magic, witchcraft, occult in general. So
bad movies about witchcraft.
Sometimes bad movies about witchcraft. So today, as we're kind of nearing the end of Black History Month, we wanted to really make sure that we gave you some resources that highlighted Black authors, writers, and bloggers. So Courtney has a list for us today.
I do.
Which we are very excited to hear about. So please go check this work out. It's really amazing work and a good way to support some of our amazing Black people in our community that are creating amazing blogging.
Right, and this is by no means an exhaustive list, but these are some authors that I feel their work is really crucial to anyone who really wants to get focused and good with witchcraft. And these are all written by Black witches. So, first of all, last week we had on Chiron Armand.
He's my boyfriend now, by the way.
All right, Chiron, I'm really sorry. need some help, we will get you.
Don't worry about it. It's a very large club. I have lots of boyfriends. 99.9% don't actually know they're my boyfriend, so you're part of a very exclusive club.
He's an unrequited exclusive club.
Yes, and I did actually buy his books afterwards, and
the Clearing Space.
Clearing Spaces is the one that I have almost finished.
Okay.
And I have the other one that I haven't started yet.
That's Deliverance, the hoodoo spells of protection.
Yes, and so I notified my husband about halfway through his first book that he is now on my boyfriend list. So, yeah, I just wanted to let everyone know, get those books because they're fantastic.
Okay, so again, this is Chiron Armand, and his two books are Clearing Space, Inspirational Techniques to Heal Your Home In, and then the second book is Deliverance, Hoodoo Spells of Uncrossing, Healing, and Protection. And then, of course, there's Queen Mother Imaku, who is the author of the Cowrie Blessings book, The New African Words of Wisdom. She's also the author of Understanding Kemetic Egyptian Spirituality. She's also a storyteller, a musician, a drummer. I used one of her albums as meditation and ritual music for a long, long time. And she actually taught me how to drum. So she's, and then she's also a motivational speaker and does really fantastic pagan and magical themed spiritual motivational speeches on her Facebook page. So definitely follow her and get those videos. She was here in Portland this past fall and hung out with Kanani and I for a while. And I know she met Hillary.
Yeah, I got to hang out with her a little bit. I got a reading from her, which was incredible.
Yeah.
I cannot sing her praises more.
Right. She was wonderful. She did our harvest ritual.
Yes.
For Pagan Pride Day. And it was
beautiful.
Phenomenal.
It was a bald eagle amazing. That flew over the
yes.
circle.
It
and
was...
as when the red energy reached its peak and everybody's
yes.
looking up staring and she just was like, oh, that's good. Like it wasn't.
Yeah. She wasn't dazed
so
at all.
We're all like, whoa!
Of course
and she's
did.
Like, she's
so
like,
amazing.
Oh, excellent. We did a good work. So, someone else I want to highlight is Irene McCalfin. She blogs about magic, but she also blogs about queerness and performance, which we'll be talking about today. She's a burlesque performer, and as also she's a social justice writer, and her blog is called mammyisdead.com. All of these blogs and links to these authors will be on our website, so if you're looking to find these people, we will be able to connect you with them. But I just came across Irene McAlphin recently, and she's clearly been around for a while, and I was just so inspired and blown away by her approach to magic and how the way she can wield that with social justice and self-acceptance when you're living outside of society's norms as a queer burlesque performer. I can't say enough great things about her. So, another one is my very dear friend, Crystal Blanton, who will actually be on our show later this season to talk about balancing witch life and work life.
Love that.
Yeah, because she is...
We all need a little bit.
She is one of the busiest witches I know. And that says a lot considering I'm sitting in the room with the two of you who are both enormous workaholics and witches. So the fact that I'm saying Crystal Blanton is one of the busiest witches I know is
That's rather shocking to me because, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
The bar for that is rather high.
I know.
It is a high bar.
So she's the author of a number of books, a few of which are Bridging the Gap and one that is called Pain and Faith in a Wiccan World. She also edited two books called Shades of Faith and Shades of Ritual. I'm sorry, three books. Shades of Faith, Shades of Ritual, and Bringing Race to the Table. She also writes about current events, particularly related to the pagan and witchcraft worlds on The Wild Hunt. So, very busy woman, very prolific, and just fantastic writer. And then also Luna Pantera, who is another person who will be on our show in a couple of weeks to discuss the magic of springtime. So she does a lot on Twitter. She's a great person to follow if you're a Twitter person. If you're in the Bay Area, you can go see her for a reading. And she has phenomenal things that she writes about and speaks about with Work of the Ancestors. So try to follow her. I'm just wild about this woman. And two more authors that are very, very popular. And Tiana Lee McKillar, the author of Root Work, Using the Folk Magic of Black America for Love, Money, and Success. Now, I have not read that one, but everybody I have seen who have read that book has just been completely floored by it. So it's apparently a really fantastic resource. And then Stephanie Rose Bird, who's very famous for her work in hoodoo, she's the author of several books, but especially known for Sticks, Stones, and Bones, Hoodoo, Mojo, and Conjuring with Herbs. So if you're looking to expand your witchcraft library, you now have your list, and we will again have a list of where you can find all of these people on our website. So, yeah.
So, thank you, by the way, Courtney.
You are welcome.
It's great to have those resources. I am very excited to start reading some of those. I think that
Stephanie Rose Bird is next on my list. I've read a lot of, all of these people are my friends.
Yeah.
So, of course, I've read their work. But Stephanie Rose Bird, I actually have never met her, but I want to pick her up next.
So what has everyone been up to this week? Anything exciting?
Yes. I just came back from Detroit. I was out there for the Creating Change Conference for my work, but also while I was there, I got to teach two classes at the Boston Tea Room, which if you're in Detroit, you must go by the store. It's absolutely phenomenal. It has a number of readers that are reading at any point of the day, and a lot of stones and herbs and books, and it's just beautiful. And so I taught two classes, one on the goddess Brigid, and talked about my book that came out a few years ago about her. I also talked about the Morgan in preparation for my book coming out this fall on that goddess. So I just love Detroit. I've like never had a bad meal in Detroit. Everybody I met there has been so good. I got to have pancakes with my friend V, who's a tarot reader, who I'm hoping will come with us to PantheaCon this year, and spent a lot of time with Heather Lee, the proprietor of Boston Tea Room, and met a lot of really fantastic witches, and that place is so full of magic. So I love Detroit, and they keep sending me back there in the wintertime, and I love it anyway, so it just shows to show you how much I really love this city.
Yeah. That's exciting. What about you, Kanani?
Well, I gotta have fun with you.
That's
Hillary.
True, we did have fun.
And I got to have fun. We got to hang out and eat some good food. And I got to drink some good wine. And Hillary actually introduced me to a new witch store, which was actually, it's a new store in town that is actually much too close to my work. That should make my husband very uncomfortable because I could walk to it from my work if I wanted to, which means I will be frequenting that store often. And
for those of you wanting to know, it's called QMEB, And it's at 1902 Northeast Broadway Street in Portland, Oregon. So it is right around the corner
It is right around the corner. And it was...
Beautiful store.
It was a small... What I liked about it was... And it was kind of... It was just how Hillary described. It's a small shop. But they're very selective with what they have. So everything they have is what you want.
Yeah, it's so specifically curated.
You're not distracted by all the normal shiny things that you're usually distracted by that kind of take away from the whole reason you really went into that store was for your specific items or your, you know, specific purpose. And I actually bought, which I was really excited about, my first Rose of Jericho. And so I am super excited.
Which is hilarious because
when Courtney saw me this morning, she's like, look, I got you something.
No, but I threw it at you and you didn't even look up. She was on her phone and I threw it at her. And it was like, you didn't even look at it. She just pushed it aside.
Then my dog almost ate it.
Then your dog almost ate it. And then all of a sudden I look and then I just start laughing. And she doesn't know why I'm laughing at this gift, which is something I would really want. And I've been saying I wanted. And it's because I just happened to buy one yesterday with Hillary at this new witch store.
Yeah, I got that. After I finished my time in Detroit, I went to New York and went with my friend Carla to this place called Original Products up in the Bronx, which I call this place Magical Walmart. Because it literally is like a superstore for magic supplies. People take grocery carts and go through the aisles.
Oh, my God.
I am not kidding you.
Wow. And they have, we need to go there
You
someday.
Have to go there now. You have to be... You, Kanani, I'm pointing at you, have to be careful because this place has so much money JoJo going for it that you literally open your wallet and throw your money at
it's
the
just
product.
Like just,
I walk in, I'm just going to need one thing. I walk out $200 later.
Target is what you're saying.
It's
the store tells you what you need. You don't tell the
store.
You're right.
Oh my God.
You don't tell the store what you need.
And my friend Carla walked out. We both said the same thing. Yeah, we did not mean to spend this money, but we didn't just bought everything.
Those are my favorite stores.
I know. Because I went and said, I'm going to get a St. Michael statue and a Rose of Jericho for Kanani. And then I was like, I also need Van Van oil and I need some Fourth Use vinegar and I need a black candle and I need some Slippery Elm. I just went on and on and on.
That's like my dream store.
Oh, and you can get a grocery cart and go through the aisles of magical supplies.
This needs to happen.
So this is in the Bronx. Again, another resource for people around the area.
I need to go there.
Yeah, yeah. And I also want to lift up Raven's Wing. I can't believe I forgot that, but it's been such a full weekend for me.
Oh, they're amazing also.
Another store here in Portland.
They also have a location in Oakland, California.
They have two locations.
Where I used to live.
It's a magical franchise.
It is a franchise.
And I actually also taught a class there just a couple of days ago, again on the Goddess Bridget, and really great people that came. So if you're listening, thank you all for coming to any of my classes, Detroit or Portland. So, yeah, our shopping and
I know, and
expeditions.
It was really fun, though. We had a really good time. And then later, we watched the Mr. Rogers documentary.
And cried.
And
oh,
cried.
My God. I literally was like, why don't we have someone that is that special? I mean, like, he's so amazing that just the way he connects with children and the way he went to seminary. He wanted to become a minister. And what I thought was beautiful about him is he preached what he believed in, not by telling people they had to believe in something, but
right.
by showing them
right.
what kindness
his
and
actions.
Love looked like.
Yeah.
His actions were his
sermons. Acceptance and inclusion.
Yeah.
Well, that was, we watched that and we cried. And one of the things that I thought was interesting that we discussed was in the documentary are his sons. And both Hillary and I are like, how bad would that suck to be the
child? It would be like the best and worst thing ever.
Yeah, like
simultaneously.
It's the best.
Are they your boyfriend? Is Mr. Rogers one of your boyfriends too? Can I?
He might be.
Oh,
you know
okay.
what? He deserves better than me. This is what I'm saying about like being his child. Like you would have like the greatest father. Not that in any way they were like not having the greatest father. They would have literally the greatest father in the world. And then to have to be compared to that for the rest of your life. Like,
and also like the greatest father in the world that also was like
everyone else's
adult figure to
yes.
every child in
everyone
that time
else's
period.
Like,
I mean, that was like a
figure.
Staple of my growing up.
Mine too.
Was Mr. Rogers'
exactly.
neighborhood, you know?
And like when I meet people, I'm like, I don't like anyone. And they're like, I don't like anyone. And I'm like, hey, we can probably be friends because we don't like anyone. Like, Mr. Rogers is like beloved by everyone.
Yeah.
And he, not just beloved by them. One of the things that Hillary and I were talking about that was so captivating about him was he loved everyone.
Yeah, like really, truly,
he genuinely, like he would talk to someone, and he was so thoroughly engaged with the person that he's talking to that that's the reason that that bond and that intrinsic chemistry existed. Whereas, you know, Hillary and I were just like, I wish I engaged with virtually anyone the way he engaged with a strange child that he's never met before. Well, I mean, it was so incredible.
And what he may not have even realized he was doing was already opening the door for acceptance of witches. He had Margaret Hamilton, who played the Wicked Witch of the West in The Wizard of Oz, on as a guest because there were so many children who were afraid of this character.
Right.
And so the actress came on and she brought her costume and she put it on and she talked about playing the role and she talked about how because of the green makeup, she couldn't feed herself, so she had to rely on other people to feed her. And she said it was really hard work, but it was really fun, too. And she was the sweetest lady.
Please don't hate me when I walk down the street.
Please don't hate me.
I know, and that's just, he would always find, what are children afraid of? Let's look underneath
that. Let's talk about it, and why, and figure out where the fear is, yeah. So, for me, other than hanging out with Kanani...
Which is the greatest time.
Which was an amazing time, and visiting the beautiful...
Even when Courtney. I'm drinking wine, it's still wonderful.
Always the peanut gallery over here with the side comments. So we had a beautiful time. QMeb was beautiful. I love visiting there. Definitely check it out if you're in the Portland area. They also, by the way, sell stuff online too. So there is that if you want to check them out. Anyway, for those of you that aren't in town. Anyway, what I have outside of hanging out with cool people been... doing recently is I have been working with some, a group of really magical witches in Portland that are starting to curate some, ritual performance art. So, my background in performance art in general, I'm a trained opera singer. I've been performing for years. And outside of regular opera, I also do, flesh hook suspension, for those of you that aren't familiar with what that is, it is the piercing of the skin with a hook and hanging from that piercing of that hook in the skin. And there's lots of people that do that privately in ritual or non-ritual senses. For a long time for me, it was like private suspensions were ritual, public suspensions were just performance art. And in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, I've started to incorporate, and actually, funny enough, like if you read older interviews, I'm like, well, I really don't incorporate the, like, it's too vulnerable, right, to do that in front of people. But as I got, I think, personally more comfortable with ritual and magic, I started realizing the value of being able to present ritual in a performance sense to people. Not always with blood magic, not always with hooks, sometimes doing vocalizations, with dance, with all sorts of other mediums of performance art. And the people that I've worked with here, they do a number of things. My friend Michelle Pacheco is an amazing woman locally. She's a tattoo artist that does ritual tattooing. She kind of drew me into this project, Synetheria Project. And which is a group of actually quite a number of people, but they have... started to really look at how to present ritual in a public environment and performances. And some of the offerings are include blood magic, but they also have ritual music, ritual movement. They often have someone there doing divination or doing readings. And it's always around some sort of intention. So they do a lot of work trying to get guidance from their particular guides or spirits or deities they work with to figure out what exactly they're calling in for what purpose. And it's been really nice because I've been able to take, to do both work with blood magic in that realm, but also, you know, using my voice to add to what we're doing. And
I'm going to interrupt you really quick, 'cause I want to ask you a question. I would like to see if you can explain to people, because I've now seen it because of you. I've now seen a show because of you, and never would have gone if it weren't for the fact that my friend Hillary is in the show and I want to go and support her and I want to see what this is about. How did you get into this? And to kind of give people, because this is very different than a lot of things that other people experience or might be familiar with in like a myriad of different ways. So I was kind of hoping you could explain to people how you got into it and how you kind of got involved and how you were exposed.
And also exactly what it is when you say body suspension work or hook work.
So I'm going to give you the very Cliff Note version because it literally could take an hour for me to explain this journey because it's been a big one. When I was first exposed to suspension, it was in a performance context, and I was asked to photograph a show by a suspension practitioner and piercer called Dana Dinius and a former piercer named Mike Pitts, who Mike is still in town, not piercing anymore. Dana lives on the East Coast now, but I used to do some photography for Dana, taking pictures of piercings he had done, and he asked me to come photograph the show. And frankly, I was a little nervous, in total honesty, because I was like, whoa, wait. So flash hook suspension, and I touched on this a little bit, but it basically is you use hooks that are traditionally fish hooks with the barb shaved off. They are sterilized. They come in different sizes. We also have hooks now that we custom make that... that are safer for suspensions that involve movement because they lock so they can't potentially bend open. I could go into depth about that, but that could also take forever. Everything is sterilized. I mean, we run exactly like a piercing shop would, so that level of
sanitation
and sterilization and aseptic technique. So the idea is what you do is you take a needle and a hook, you pierce with the needle, you place the hook into the skin. It's normally sometimes fewer hooks, but it's a variety of how many hooks there are based on the position the person wants to be in, the comfort level of the person. And you attach them to often a rigging system, like a pulley system, or sometimes to a physical solid structure. And you then lift the weight of their body up with the hooks.
So these people are literally suspended
from their skin.
From their skin with giant hooks in them.
They're actually not huge. They're smaller than you would think. They're not tiny, tiny, because that could be dangerous and they wouldn't support weight. But, you know, when I went to see this show, I was like, I was genuinely really going, oh my gosh, what if it's terrible? What if these people are in agony? I don't know what I'm getting into, but I was like, I want to support my friend. I want to go, kind of like you.
Right.
And I went and I saw this show and I was so incredibly moved by the piece that they did. And what emotions and beauty were expressed through this art form that it's like this concept in my head of, oh my God, what if it's awful, completely faded away. And I was like completely blown away. I think I took like 3 photographs because I was just frozen watching this show, just being blown away. The group back then was called Transcend. And so I just went, oh my God. And so I walked up and I was like, oh my gosh, you guys, this was so amazing. Oh my gosh, I don't even know what to say. This is so amazing. You had live music on stage. I am a singer. I would love to perform with you. Not suspended, obviously, because that would be crazy, but like, doing the thing. And they were like, wouldn't that be cool? And I was like, no. And it took me a long time to come around to trying it. But what led me ultimately to try it originally was because I couldn't get the idea of taking something so powerful vocally with something so powerful visually and putting those two elements together. And what I found was that they complement each other well, because the music, which is very beautiful and entrancing, softens the suspension. Mm. And the suspension also makes opera more accessible in a certain way. Opera is like, oh, you know, that's for snooty people in a concert hall and the tickets are expensive and that's not for me. So it kind of both presented two different things that aren't really accessible to people in the most accessible package that I could put it in. And I can tell you that I have performed, I performed all over the world. I performed on 4 continents, at all sorts of different performance art festivals, body art festivals, suspension events, tattoo conventions, so many different things. Like I've done like government sponsored art festivals before. So it has started to become a widely accepted or more accepted form of art. It definitely is not for everyone to do. And I totally honor people that it's too intense to see. It is usually people in my shows say like I cried or I was so moved, same kind of the reaction that I had to my original exposure. So And in recent years, I've really worked on bringing not just the performance element in, but also bringing in intention to the performance that I think elevates it in an even better way. And also,
so it's like adding magical intention to your performance.
Exactly. So it's really bringing in what has become really sacred to me in my own practice, magic practice, and offering that to others, because I mean, I think that it allows the audience to experience and witness something that's really beautiful, but also benefit from the energy that's created in that space.
Yeah.
And we, you know, each of the performances very specifically detail out what's happening. We also make sure that there are people there to tend to people. So if something is too overwhelming, either because it's blood magic or just because the energy in the room is too much, we have people that are grounded that are there to help, you know, help people. And I'm never offended if people say, oh, visually that's too much, they need to turn away, whatever. You know, it's I want people to be comfortable. So what I've been able to do with this ritual group here is really fine. Each performance has a different intention. And I think it brings up a good point. You know, sometimes we see ritual portrayed in theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is a difference between ritual portrayed and ritual.
So like a ritual portrayed in theater might be if you go to see Macbeth.
Right.
And there are witches performing and conjuring. But chances are, and I don't know, maybe you actually have some witch actors who are actually conjuring, but most of the time these witches are demonstrating a ritual.
Yeah,
but they're not actually.
Agreed.
So here's my question for you, because I know you as a witch, and I know you cast spells with your own materials at home, you know, saying your intention and using your materials to make a change happen. So how does that practice fit in with a performance?
So generally it comes in from, so when the conception of the performance happens, so when I'm sitting there designing it out or I'm working with others to design it, it usually comes from a place of we are sitting down and trying to connect with our guides to try and figure out what the intent needs to be and use our intuition on what it needs to be, or there is a specific issue that we want to affect specifically or change, and then that's the focal. So I think that the difference between portraying and actually creating ritual in a performance is the intent behind what you're doing.
Yeah.
That you are actually putting together something, that you're not going, oh, look at, here I am lighting this, here I am, you know, conjuring this, here I am stirring a call, you know, are the things that you are doing, is the intention to create magic with that thing?
Yeah.
And that's what we really incorporate in.
I have an experience that I feel has the same spirit, although
yeah.
it's wildly different.
Totally.
So a few years ago, some friends of mine were, some African-American friends of mine were doing an event for just African-American women to watch Lemonade, the Beyonce video,
yeah.
and which is itself an act of magic. It truly, truly is. And I asked if I could donate lemon bars because I wanted to support the event, and said absolutely. So I didn't just make lemon bars. I made lemon bars with the specific intent that anyone who ate one had the experience at this film that they truly needed. So it wasn't just, you know, for fun and
yeah.
because they're tasty. It was actually, that became a magical act, the baking. So there is baking because you love to bake.
Yeah.
And then sometimes there's baking because you want to affect change.
Yes,
and so
exactly.
that's when you're saying this. There are some performances where you want to move people, you want to inspire people. That's great. And that's what it should do. And then there are some rituals, is what I hear you saying, which are about actually manifesting energetic change,
yes.
either for the people watching
yeah.
or for the world around them.
Exactly.
Okay. I got it. I'm in.
You're in. And I mean, I use a lot of suspension and blood magic in my rituals. There are plenty of people that do other types of performance art involving rituals. So don't think if you're going to a ritual performance art that it's for sure going to have blood involved.
I mean, I've done ritual performance art, which had no blood.
Exactly.
So, and we've had kids there because I think
yeah.
there's a certain amount of theatrics within ritual.
Sure.
It's really great to communicate
yes.
the message.
And
you know?
make it
yeah.
tangible and digestible for people. They can see it. and help them understand what it's creating. Because sometimes we say things or do things and they're like, I don't know what they're doing or why are they doing that?
But what you're calling up is that using blood and magic is really, really old.
It's very old.
We're talking about like pre-Christian religions in Western Europe often utilized blood, whether it was from a sacrificed animal or sometimes a sacrificed human. Now, make this very clear, we don't sacrifice humans anymore. But I do know that even well into the 20th century, there, some of these old spell books involve the witch pricking their finger and putting a little of their blood into it. Now, we say this with a disclaimer.
I do.
You do not have to do it. You should do it safely.
Yeah, I want to stress that, like, make sure that if you are, you know, I normally say don't try this at home. Or if you are looking into blood magic, I urge you to connect with someone that knows how to do it safely in a sterile way, that there's not going to be any spread of disease or anything.
I say that is this may be a foreign concept to some people listening to this, but what you're actually talking about is a very old tradition.
It's a very old tradition.
So for myself and my practice, that is not something that has ever been a part of it. And so what was interesting for me is one of the books that I have recommended was Grimoire of a Thorn-Blooded Witch, written by Raven Grimassi, which I was talking about. I absolutely love, love, loved. And one of the reasons I loved it was it came down to the basic relationship between a witch and nature. And one of the things that surprised me when I read the book was that there actually is a discussion on the witch connecting herself with spirit and with the plant spirits through the exchange of her own, like a drop of blood and a drop of the plant's chloroform. And so in a lot of the practices and a lot of the studies and things that I've done, that's not really something that's talked about. So it was actually kind of surprising to me, though when you're reading it, you know, it's not talking about large amounts of blood and it's not talking
about
anything.
You're not opening a vein.
It's nothing that's scary. Like you think of, you know, Sleeping Beauty, prick your finger on, you know, like, so it's nothing... Yeah.
Most of us have a scratch somewhere. You could probably pick the scab open. There you got blood.
Nothing. It wasn't anything intimidating, but it was interesting to me. And it also, but at the same time, it doesn't feel jarring because when you think about going back to that initial concept of a witch and nature and the world around her, there is a very primal aspect to that. And when you get to that kind of a very primal place, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it doesn't feel as shocking as it might if you just kind of overtly think about it. When you think about magic in a very primal sense, it makes sense.
Makes sense, yeah. And I think there are a lot of people doing some pretty amazing work out there that involves hook suspension or blood magic. There's also a woman named Jessica Irvin. She actually curates performance pieces. And she does them, well, I don't think it's specifically, I don't think she's casting spells while she's doing it. I think she curates pieces that allows people to highlight a number of social justice issues or issues that are very emotional or issues to heal people that have been affected by trauma. So it's more healing than like casting, but I think the work that she...
The greatest kind of magic is healing.
And she runs a project called Skin Project, which is going to be happening in the Bay Area in late May this year. So you can check them out. And I'll put a link to any relevant information there. And then there's a group called Coven of Ashes that's in L.A.
I love that name. It's really beautiful. Coven of Ashes is so
Lauren Davis and Missy Munster. Missy Munster does incredible, really incredible headpieces. I mean, her stuff has been photographed and used in so many performance pieces and by famous people, by local people. She does incredible art. And Lauren is a practicing witch, and they do pieces that involve blood magic. Some hook work and some piercing and spears and stuff, but they also do a lot of work. They'll pick a specific issue, and it's a very intense performance art, but really, really powerful and really amazing. And then Luna Doran is in Berlin. She does ritual hook suspension and does some really beautiful pieces as well. And I can link you to some of her work. I think she also does a lot of photographed pieces, and she's just, they're just stunning. And like, you really, even in her photographs, when you see it, you can feel the power coming off of what that image is. Really breathtaking, and really moving. And that kind of leads me to, I asked a guest to come on today. And the reason I asked this guest to come on is because I feel like she embodies a number of styles of performance art, from dance to blood magic to, I mean, many forms of movement. Actually, most of her stuff is movement based, and she is also a brilliant visual artist. So we'll be talking to Raven Ebner today.
Yeah.
So excited.
Woohoo!
So Raven Ebner is a multimedia visual artist, fabricator, and performer whose practices in the occult are very much wrapped up in her art. She takes an intuitive approach to her ritual and sigil work, choosing to create her own path as she goes rather than sticking to any one established tradition. She was raised in a traditionally religious family and initially eschewed ritual before coming back around to rediscover how to make it come to life for herself. Her involvement with body modification and flesh hook suspension are other facets of her practice. As a performer, she choreographs fusion dance pieces, both as a soloist as well as for her troupe Ego Umbra, that explores archetypal themes, ritual, and sigils formed with the body to impact emotions and consciousness of both dancers and audience alike. Her practices center around communication with the subconscious and the body as the medium through which magic and change can occur. Through all modes of art, her goal is transformation of the self and offering up of anything useful found in the process as a gift to anyone else it may serve. So I've known Raven for quite a while, actually.
And I mean, basically, you just said she's a fucking badass.
I did say, okay, she was a fucking badass.
So you could have made that a lot shorter.
I could have been, okay. I could have been like Raven.
And Raven, hashtag magic, hashtag badass, hashtag you need to listen to the section.
Raven also is known as Corvid, okay, Art. She has a website which we're going to link on our...
And you should go because the pictures are so drop dead, soul-shaking, beautiful.
They're incredible.
That you just kind of pass out. So have your smelling salts.
Yeah, be
there
ready.
By your phone. Because you're going to need them to bring yourself back to life after looking at this person's pictures. Just saying.
So I met Raven a number of years ago when we worked together with Core, who I mentioned earlier in the episode. And I've always been really blown away by what Raven does. I think she has this incredible way of, with both visual, physical, and performance art, specifically movement-based art, that just like connects the audience in a way. You just stand there and you're going, this is amazing. And it leaves such energy that resonates with the audience. And so I felt like bringing her on, and I mentioned this earlier, Raven, I really felt that you embodied so many different forms of art that incorporated ritual versus just one or the other. So that's why I thought that this would be great to have you on. So everybody, please welcome Raven Ebner to the show. And we just have a couple of questions for you. And we'd love to hear a little bit about kind of the things you do and are working on. So first, how is your day going?
Hi, it's going all right.
Wonderful. Have you been doing anything excited recently?
Yeah, sort of. Like on a work level, I've been delving a lot more into fabrication and design. But it's actually left very little room for a lot of my own art. So I'm going through a process of trying to reconnect to that. And then on a personal level, I've actually been in a months-long personal ritual that has been sort of amazing and harrowing, and it's actually involving a good deal of body modification, where I am tattooing my entire head.
Whoa.
And they're all personal sigils, and they're all sigils kind of becoming. And so I'm going through this transformation, and I'm starting to experience the effects of this sort of almost growing outside of the bounds of my, you know, control or intention. So like, of course you can't endeavor to do something like this and expect that it's always going to be easy or pleasant or that you'll have, you know, control over the outcome. So I'm trying to just sort of weather what is a pretty intense ongoing experience.
That's amazing. I'm so glad that you have this space in your life to kind of go through that transitional process. I feel like there are a lot of people around me that I feel like are going through major transitions. And I think that that's so powerful, and I can't wait to see what you know what
is. You were on the advent of spring here, so that just really seems to be tied, at least within in the northern hemisphere. Well, in the southern hemisphere too, they're heading into autumn.
Yeah, and something
so
here, new.
Yeah, and so this is it. Just we're in this tremendous space of transformation globally.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Can you talk to me a little bit about when magic or witchcraft became a part of your life and what kind of drew you to that in general?
Mm-hmm. I think that having been raised Catholic and then, you know, as you mentioned in when you introduced me, that I ended up leaving that belief system, questioning it, not finding, you know, anything that resonated with me and leaving it behind. So where I think all of this came in was in the vacuum that created. And what I spent kind of a lot of time with sort of aimless exploration with it, not really feeling like I was finding myself. But I think where I started to find myself was when I started to come into my own as an artist. And my practice as an artist is very, very much tied up in my spirituality, in my practice of magic. And what being an artist taught me about my spirituality and about things like ritual and all the trappings of like how we explore our own spirituality is that I had complete agency and a blank canvas. So like I went from this rooted tradition of like, here's how the ritual goes, and here's the words you say, and here's, you know, all of this, and it's written tradition, and it's done as a group, to and thinking that's all ritual was, and that it was kind of empty for me. And of course it was, because I hadn't found how I connected to it. And so when I realized I have permission to make something up completely on my own, and that is, you know, if that's what's more meaningful to me, and that, and you know, as I began engaging in that process, I learned, yeah, of course, that is exactly how it becomes alive for me, and that I have complete agency. And so that practice and just art, like, you know, painting, making things, became inextricably intertwined for me, and have just developed more and more to this day.
Do you think that there was anything in particular that was there like an aha moment where you thought, you know, ritual had a place in your art, or did it just kind of develop
simultaneously? Did you have a come to goddess moment?
I think, you know, sometimes I talked earlier a little bit about how for a long time I really separated ritual from performance art because I was like, this is, it's vulnerable and personal. And then I slowly started to see the power of doing that publicly and how that could affect change, but also affect those that were witnessing. Did that just kind of come naturally through your journey, or was there a moment that you thought, oh man, this is, I really want to incorporate more in?
I think it was a slow dawning rather than a single moment. Lots of little revelations along the way. And then, you know, I moved to the Bay Area about 13 years ago, and there was a lot bigger presence of kind of what we engage in now. Performers, people who do rituals, performance, and things like that. And I also became involved in suspension not long after, you know, I moved here. So I think it was seeing that being done around me and being inspired by other people who went before me and being involved in, you know, becoming involved with CORE, which was a troupe that combined ritual and performance and suspension, and realizing that that's a thing. And so after engaging in that, then I started to kind of go back and look at it and go, what does this mean for me? Why am I drawn to this idea of ritual and performance? And a lot of times too, there was discussion going on around this and people saying, well, how can you have, you know, ritual, which is your spirituality and this private stuff, and how can that be valid as performance, performative thing, and being faced with those questions and wanting to engage in that conversation and having to figure out what exactly did I think about that. So slow progression over time for me.
It is a hard thing. I mean, I definitely found myself in that situation, and I know other performers that have as well, where it's like this, you know, ritual is such a deeply personal thing. But I felt like we talked a little bit earlier about kind of defining like presenting ritual as in portraying ritual versus actually doing ritual in performance art. So, you know, there's oftentimes scenes in plays or movies or whatever where they are in, like reenacting a ritual or like acting it on stage. And we really discussed that the difference was really where the intent was, whether you were just recreating something that someone had done or whether you were creating a ritual where you were pulling in certain elements specifically with an intent and purpose to affect change or move it, or affect the experience of the audience, or even if it was deeply personal to yourself. And I know as a performer myself, I feel like I really learned that sharing that with people was really inspiring to them. And I have had people since kind of going to on that journey to offering more ritual in performance art that really came forward and were like, what, you know, where can I find out about this? And I think that's a great way to reach people also. So can you tell me about a piece that was particularly powerful or impactful for you that you created that kind of sticks out in your mind?
This kind of touches back on what we were saying about the sort of spectrum of rituals, like if they're personal versus public. And I would say for me that my performance pieces, they range from the public like pieces that I put on for a show, and those tend to be more like dance pieces that, you know, I, as a soloist or my troupe is performing. And usually those are more on the spectrum of like, I wouldn't call it pure ritual. I would definitely say this is more performance that has elements of ritual. It uses the trappings of ritual. It's perhaps, you know, it's more like a display of ritual versus, you know, that idea of like the pure intention behind, you know, a ritual without it being as much focus on performance. And then the stuff I do that is more purely ritual, I've done it with and in front of groups of people, but it's not generally, it's not generally like on a stage in a performance. But I actually more recently have been looking at crossing that over more and kind of blurring the boundary between them. And really recently I did actually have an experience where I was getting ready to perform on a stage. It was, you know, it was a lineup of performers. This was at an event called Wasteland Weekend. And, you know,
I'm familiar with Wasteland. Yeah.
The name of these things. It's a post-apocalyptic
thing. It's amazing.
Theme.
Think Mad Max.
Oh my God.
It's really cool.
I love it.
It's really, really cool. It's, I've been invited to perform there for the last few years. I perform with a group called the Hell Sirens. And then I was going to be performing in a group on their stage. They're called the Wasted Saints. And they had me, slotted to perform. And I was, and this wasn't very long ago. This was just this last year, near the end of the year, like September. And I was going to prepare my piece and choreograph something and practice something and put on this performance. And that kind of all went out the window. I mean, a lot of it, like I said earlier, how I've been going through this very intense personal ritual and transformation. But a lot of it has meant a great deal of depression and struggle, just daily struggle with my mental state. And I don't create as well when I'm in a depressed state. I can't, some people need, you know, they create a lot from their depression. I do, but after I'm out of that state.
Yeah.
Can't do it while I'm in it.
Well, that's one of the things people don't realize is that working with magic and energies like that will take you to those places.
It really
does.
You know,
not to leave you there, but to help you get through them.
Absolutely. So, and in fact, that's exactly what happened was I came right up to the performance. You know, it was like the day of, I had no preparation. And I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do up there. All I have is like the music selected, but that's it. And so I decided to make this a very personal ritual. And what I was going to do was I was going to take everything that I was feeling in that moment and I was going to embody it on stage and let it take me over, be a vessel for it. And like, you know, what I was feeling was very much depression and despair and like just this sort of it's like this self-annihilation wanted to take over me, very much dancing with nothingness and with my own kind of shadow self. So I was just like, okay, I'm just gonna go up there and see what happens. And I created a sigil kind of in the moment. I was doing my makeup and I was just kind of making myself look sort of hideous, and I put this sigil on my forehead, and went out there and just let myself become everything I was feeling. I just sort of let my actual self just fade away and dance that out. And so that really felt like that was a personal ritual that I was putting on display, and it was also a powerful lesson in the fact that things, like, you can't always prepare. Things are not always, or that preparation doesn't always look like how you expect, because I am meticulous. I like to be prepared. I like to choreograph, and whatever was going on for me, it was like, nope. Nope, you don't get any of that. I'm sorry. But it forced me to discover something really powerful, which was, you know, being in the moment and being extremely present and being fully embodied and being fully a vessel in this moment and sharing that with people. And, you know, the response I got from that was one of the most powerful people telling me that, like, they kind of didn't really know what was going on, but it sort of, like, it frightened them or it overwhelmed them or it made them want to cry. And so it also was a good reminder of, like, you know, if you are honest and raw, and I try to do this in a lot of my pieces on stage, but I don't always do it quite that fully. If you are fully honest and present, people will go on that journey with you. And the cross section that between ritual and performance that's important here that I kind of learned a little bit more about here was that idea of how, like, the point of making ritual into performance is because personal ritual being about sort of self-transformation, the whole point of the performance is that you're trying to give that as a potential gift to your audience. So you're not just giving them an experience in the moment or a memory. You're hoping that, you know, they will witness this and sort of see something of themselves in it or realize something and go through a transformation with you, which, I mean, can sometimes just be said about performance art and art in general. But with ritual, again, I agree with you that really the difference can be the intention. So, and then interesting, just kind of an epilogue to that was I was, again, going to be giving that same performance with that same bit of music, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to do it again. But this time we'll see if preparation looks any different. And it kind of looked exactly the same, because I'm still going through all this and I still was unable to, like, prepare. But I had some conversations with some friends around it and started talking about the process and had some feedback around, you know, really, like, maybe preparation just looks different. Maybe here preparation doesn't look like choreographing and practicing. Maybe it looks like digging even deeper into this process of what's happening for you. And so I kind of dug in, and some of that meant just kind of sitting there with the discomfort of, like, I feel totally unprepared. I'm just going to go up there and I don't even know what's going to happen. And just sitting with that and seeing what it meant for me. And then when I went to go up there a second time to do, and this was months later, at a different venue, I ended up drawing a sigil that took the sigil I initially put on my forehead as the root of it and extended it. And the sigil was about the transformation of pain and despair and, like, in feeling incapacitated, feeling a lack of agency, and all the things I was learning about it from that transforming into artistic honesty and presence, and taking something that seems ugly and scary and making it into something powerful and beautiful in a sort of bittersweet sense. And put that, this time I put that sigil like on my whole body, and then went up there and danced the piece again, and sort of felt like it was a full circle experience. And so that, you know, that's all been recent, and I think that that's going to start transforming how I really try to embody that intersection of true ritual and performance. So we'll see where that goes.
So, you know, I've seen you use, I know in your bio you talk about using shapes to create sigils through dance. So I know sigils have been a huge part of your magical practice. Was that something that you kind of innately came to, or was, did you learn about sigils? How did you get involved in sigil work?
I kind of was intuitively drawn to it. I think that I came to it through my painting and illustration process. I sort of just started, I would just draw symbols and think like, you know, this represents this to me, and I'm going to put this in my work and sort of develop the meaning around it. And then in many ways, my magical practice has mirrored my artistic practice in that way, because, you know, with art, I've had certain kinds of art where I had too much formal training. That is like music. And then I completely stifled my creativity. And so other things I was like, no, I'm going to stay completely self-taught, even though that might be disadvantageous at times. And I kind of did that with sigils, because for me, my belief around magic has to do with, it has a sort of cognitive framing. I believe that we're talking to our own kind of subconscious selves, and that subconscious self connects to, you know, something bigger, and that's kind of where that sense of like connecting to the spirit world or the universe or however you, or God, or however anyone wants to frame it, I think are all equally valid ways. So with sigils, I started out kind of very roughly and very vaguely, and my sigil working practice developed and honed over time as I engaged in it. One of the turning points for sigil work for me was actually at a certain suspension campout retreat that some of us know and love. And
this was an all-female retreat, and Raven's, it was, the sigil work was Raven's gift to this beautiful retreat.
Oh, I love
that. It was really amazing.
Yeah, that was a transformative experience for me. I got the idea because one of the folks who runs and organizes a retreat asked me to do a sigil slash logo, like a sigil as logo for the piece, for the whole event. And so as I was doing that, part of my process, I was looking at like the idea of like any given suspension, the body, the visceral experience of it, and was kind of drawing on that for some of my lines and shapes. And I was like, oh, you know, what'd be really cool is to witness each suspension and draw a sigil for it. And then like, hand that to the person at some point later.
It was really, really incredible to see.
It grew into something pretty, pretty much bigger than I thought.
Huge undertaking.
I started that weekend, like, I'm going to do as many as I can. And then I was like, wait,
oh my God. Yeah.
Ow. And then it's I ended up witnessing every single one and making a sigil. And so I got like a ton of practice at sigil work in the moment. And so what I do with my sigil work now is it's a combination of like visual elements, whatever relates to what's going on. It's a form of abstract art, basically. I'm taking emotion. I'm taking, the idea of like, movement and just all of these things, and abstracting them into lines and shapes and forms. And then a sort of intuitive process, which is just, it's almost like automatic writing. I'll do that with painting and drawing, automatic drawing and like lines will come up and I'll be like, no, it doesn't feel right. And I'll try it again. Or yes, that does feel right. I'm leaving it in. So there's some of that. And so if you looked at it, if you looked at one of my sigils and I were to explain to you what was going on, I think anyone would be able to kind of understand it.
Yeah.
So with that sigil, the initial one in the first performance was purely, it was a very, very simple one, but it was purely just intuitive. I just like drew something on me and kind of like just carving it in and it felt right. And then later as I developed, I sat and let more of the intuition come in and some more of the kind of abstraction come in as well. Cause you know, like whether a line's thick or thin or flowing or geometric, or if it looks angry and dark or if it's light and colorful, you know, these are all things that
you tap into. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to make sure we have enough time to ask you a little bit about any upcoming work or performances that you'd like to mention. And then any websites or places that people can find both your performance art, but also your physical art. And so I want to make sure we get enough time to do that. Can you talk to us a little bit about how to find you and where you're going to be? I know you travel a lot for shows and.
Yeah, I have a website. That's a good place to kind of look at all my work. It's deathvine.com.
And we'll put all this up on the website.
It'll be all on the website.
Our website.
Yeah.
Okay. And what about upcoming performances?
I have one right now that I'm, it's going to be a pretty massive undertaking. I'm doing a solo performance in a dark dance fusion festival. It's called Requiem. It's coming up, the weekend of, April 5th to the 7th, and it's in Fresno, California. It's the first year of this. It's really exciting. I'll be teaching a workshop actually on Saturday, April 6th. It's, from concept to creation. So it's about creating a dance performance piece, how to embody your concept through all the aesthetic and movement aspects of your piece. So from your costume and makeup to your movement. So I will actually be low key, including the sort of, things that I include in ritual and all that to convey an idea. So sigil work, symbols, those aesthetics, how to bring that across to your audience and how to kind of bring them on that journey with you. And then I'll be performing a solo piece that night on April 6th in the Saturday night show, which is called Tales from Death's Parlor. So I'll be doing a piece that's death themed.
Amazing. And what is there a website for that so people can find info on that event?
Yes, it is. Let me make sure I get this right. Oh, it's a requiemdarkfusionfestival.com.
Great.
And I'll send you that so you can post it too.
And then for Ego Umbra, is there a website for that also?
So on deathvine.com.
They're on Deathvine. Okay.
It's my personal website. There is a section for Ego Umbra, and so there's videos. You can see our performances there.
Great. We always wrap up our podcast with what we call, rather than as above, so below, we say as below, so above. And what we do is we say, this is what we're going to write down. We write down something on a piece of paper that we want to release, and then we put it in a cauldron and we burn it, and then we also offer what we want to bring in. So what we're going to release and what we're asking to come in. So if you'd like to participate with us, we can write something down and do it for you, or you can do it at home. But we'd love for you to participate if you're down.
Yeah, definitely.
Great. So do you want to start, Courtney?
Yeah. I want to let go of something that's been holding me back for quite a while. I actually saw a meme yesterday that really spoke to me. It said, beware if you let others drag you down to the point where you lash out at them and then they blame you for that. So I have some problems with it because I think we have to be responsible for our own actions. I think that meme tends to put the blame on the antagonizer instead of owning it yourself. But I feel like I went into that place for a while where I was getting so upset with the way I was being treated in certain spaces that I was starting to become like the people who were treating me in a way I didn't want to be treated. So that's one thing I'm letting go of. And so I'm trying to get back up on do the Michelle Obama, when they go low, we go high, and trying to get back up on my Michelle Obama platform. And what I would like to embrace is more rest, because I haven't slept in 2 nights and I would really love to sleep tonight.
So for me, I really want to, so I recently, I'm kind of doing some career changes and working on some new projects, and I have a habit of, if it's not working right away, getting like really mad at myself and being like, oh, why can't you do this? And really coming down hard on myself. And it's a really bad habit, because 9 times out of 10, if I just sit with it and I'm patient with myself, I can get through it. So I am letting go of the voices in my head that tell me I'm not good enough to do it, or that that if it's not, doesn't come to me right away, it's not good enough. And I am bringing in really just making enough time for myself, and making sure that I balance time for myself with time for others, which is something that I'm really bad at. So what I'm asking to come in is honoring the time I need for myself, so that I can actually be more available for others. Kanani?
So this has been very interesting. And since our first podcast, one of the things that I've discussed is that I am so chronically busy all the time, and I am constantly doing a million different things, and I have made a very conscious effort to slow my life down, to not be obligated to doing so many things, and to try and be relaxed as I am doing, juggling a lot of things. And I ironically have been fairly successful at doing that. And something I did not anticipate happening was I now feel a tremendous amount of guilt for how busy I have kept myself, and realizing how much I have missed by why didn't I do this, 6 years ago? Why have I been constantly juggling 100 balls in the air? You know, what have I missed because I've been so preoccupied with X, Y, and Z? So that is kind of a weird feeling, because on one hand, I'm very much enjoying my life a lot more now than I have in a really long time. But at the same time, I'm starting to feel guilt and worry about, was it wrong to have kept myself so busy for so long and to have taken on so many obligations? So I am going to let go of the guilt of my past behavior, because I am very happy in my right now. And if I didn't have all those things that had happened, I might not be in my right now. And the truth is, I'm incredibly happy in my right now. So I am letting go of the guilt of what was, because I cannot change it. And if it led me to right now, then I'm okay. And I'm just wanting to bring in more calm. Continue bringing in more calm and more peace. And I'm enjoying the slowing of life down a little bit.
Raven, what about you?
I'm sensing a theme in our intentions, and mine fit right in with that. It's I'm wanting to let go of the fact that I attach so much of my self-worth to my productivity and what I create. And instead of just being able to be present and not attaching my worth to any particular thing. And part of that has to do with I've not, other than a few exceptions, I've not been doing much art just for myself. Just the art that I want to make. Everything's a commission or, a job or something like that. And I want to be able to also embrace the cyclic nature of things, and including my own energy levels and creativity, because for so long I just pushed myself to go and create and make and always be extremely busy. And rather than letting myself go through these sort of hibernation processes where I am letting things gestate and grow and letting the change happen, without needing to be active. So.
Awesome.
All right, we're going to put them in the cauldron.
So we're going to put them in the cauldron. So and mote it be.
So mote it be. And once that torrential downpour stops, we can probably light something on fire. But until then.
It was crazy. It came out of nowhere. God. I was like, what?
It sounded like you had a pipe burst.
I know. I was like, uh-oh.
Nope.
I'm going to get rained on.
It's the sky.
It's the sky. Well, Raven, thank you so much. We so appreciate you coming on That Witch Life, and we're really excited to promote the work you do.
It's exceptional.
It's really amazing.
Yeah. Thank
we
you
really
so
loved
much.
What you had to say.
I think we should do a whole talk on sigils one day. I think
that would be awesome.
Yet another thing. So thank you for reminding us.
Thank you for reminding us.
Of course. Yeah, thank you so much. Absolutely an honor to be on your show and get to talk to you about this. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Join us on the first and third Mondays of the month for magical tools, tips, and stories about living as a witch in today's world.
Find us at thatwitchlife.com for archived episodes or to ask your burning questions for us to answer in a future podcast.